Hi, and welcome to a special bonus episode of The Agency. Eugene here in Toronto.
Hi, Eugene. It's Candy here in Chicago, and hello to our listeners. How are you doing today?
I'm sore, Candy.
Uh-oh. What happened?
Well, here's what happened. The other day, our friend Hobie stopped by.
Mm-hmm.
And Hobie stopped by to pick up a copy of issue 4 of Squeezebox Man.
Great.
The graphic novel that everybody needs. And we were chit-chatting about this and that, and he's been going out for nature walks, and he's got a new camera, and I said, hey, you know, I think my knee's getting good enough that I could probably do a relatively short nature walk, and suggested that next week, one early morning, we meet at Lambton Woods,
mm-hmm.
and we do that. And then he hopped on his bicycle and rode away. And okay. I started thinking about that. And I started thinking, I wonder if I can actually do that walk.
Oh, my God.
So I thought I'd better do the walk to see if I could do the walk.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I don't want to drag Hobie out there, get a third of the way through the walk, and then, like, be a whiner because I can't really do the walk.
You'll be like that guy in the bad movies, like Sierra Madre or whatever. They're
exactly.
going across the boundaries, and they're like, slap your face. Pull yourself together, buddy. Get a grip. Yo, go on. Save yourself.
Exactly. So I hopped on my trusty steed, and I went over to Lambton Woods.
A trusty steed? Do you mean bicycle?
No, I can't ride a bicycle yet. By Honda Fit.
All right. Okay.
So I went to Lambton Woods, which is right beside James Gardens. Have you ever been there?
I don't think I have.
It's along the Humber River.
Okay.
It's kind of a famous place in Ontario right now because allegedly,
mm-hmm.
Allegedly, I think according to the Globe and Mail, allegedly,
yes,
our premier, in his younger days, when he should have been attending high school, was allegedly a drug dealer dealing hash out of the James Gardens parking lot.
Oh, there you go. Well, if anyone has any evidence on that, please notify me.
Yeah, I have no idea if that's true or not. People keep telling me it's true.
I think it's true.
He was apparently a neighborhood bully. And anyway, so that in our area, in Etobicoke, that's well known as allegedly the place where he hung out and did business.
Okay.
Well, now it's just, you know, an ordinary parking lot, I guess.
Right.
They don't have a sign up for it for him.
Is it? It sounds very pretty. Lambton sounds very pretty. It's
Lambton.
Lambton. Okay, that sounds pretty too.
Lambton. Lambton. It's along the Humber River, and you can actually, from there, you could park your car and you could walk right almost to the lake.
Oh, very nice.
Along the Humber River. It crosses a couple of times. I used to ride my bicycle when I was a kid along there. We would ride down to, we got to the filtration plant at the Queensway. And I think somehow or another, we had to leave the river in order to get past all the expressway nonsense to get down to the lake. In any case, there is a nice little loop trail that goes through a woods. And the loop I was thinking of goes as far as there's a footbridge just past a railway trestle. And my plan was to walk through the woods to the railway trestle. And then walk back the trail that goes along the river.
Okay.
Which I did this morning.
Yeah, good.
And I did quite well. I didn't have any problem with the uneven ground.
All right.
My muscles were quite, you know, I was feeling them as I was going for sure, because I was putting them to a real more of a test than I have.
Right.
And I got back in my car and I thought, hey, I did pretty darn good. That's no problem at all. And I came home and I sat down, and then they got sore.
Oh, wow. That's a fast response.
Yeah.
Did you ice and cool down or heat or anything
like that? I had a nap.
Oh, good. I think that's a great idea. That was all this morning?
That was all this morning.
Oh,
I had a nap, and my nap, I had a dream about having to take my car to a mechanic. And it was my mechanic, but my mechanic had moved to some kind of industrial complex that was attached to a mall. And I had to wait while he did whatever he had to do with my car. And I somehow got lost in this labyrinth of industrial complex.
Wow.
And I couldn't find my way back to my mechanics.
That sounds like my everyday.
So I don't know anything about dreams, really. And right. I barely remember my dreams. But I remembered that one because it's very frustrating to be lost.
Yes,
and I was going down all kinds of funky stairways.
Yes.
And every time I went down a stairway, it opened up into this whole new dream world with all kinds of people. And at one point, I opened a door and there was an amusement park. Mm. I was like the wild mouse was going by me.
Oh, what a very interesting dream. I'm sometimes pretty good at dream interpretation. I'll think about it, but I guess my immediate thought was one that, you know, I went to the mechanic this week.
Sure,
so maybe it plowed into your head.
How's
you
your
had,
car?
You had a compassionate trauma experience of going to the mechanic with me. Car's fine. But I think also I'm seeing it as somehow triggering parts of your consciousness that you're going into. That's my gut feeling. Is it maybe it's the paintings you're doing right now or something. Maybe it's the reading you're doing. I'm seeing it as representative of different aspects of your consciousness. But I'll really try and think about that for a little bit.
My first thought was it had to do with painting.
Yeah,
I painted quite
funny.
Late last night. And my painting's been going exceptionally well. And I had another little breakthrough last night on a painting I'm calling Dead Man's Fingers.
Well, there you go. I really think that is something to do with your dream. Because you're tapping into all those just different processes in your mind.
Yeah, I think so. Different areas of
my
imagination.
The feeling of lost, was it an uncomfortable feeling of lost or a positive feeling of lost? Did you feel like you could fix it?
I was trying to fix it, but it was getting uncomfortable when my plan to fix it was a dismal failure.
Right.
And then I woke up.
All right.
And I woke up and I looked at, there was a clock in the room in which I was having the nap. Uh-huh. And I couldn't tell if it was 12:50 or 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
It was one of those things. I had no idea how long I slept.
You know what? I kind of love those weird feelings like that, because that is, you're getting close to that nature of questioning what I'm trying to figure out, what's the nature of reality here. So I think that's kind of cool. I was thinking, you know, there I was whining about my car and my iPhone, I have to get a new battery. And I'm thinking, you know what? Those are really good problems to have. You know, no matter how bad things are, those are actually really good problems to have. And I'm kind of grateful for it. They can be fixed and I'm not starving to death. In fact, I'm the opposite of starving to death. I ran into one of my old coworkers and they're like, oh, you didn't lose weight in the quarantine. I went, no, I've gained weight. And they go, yeah, I see it in your face. I'm like, okay, fuck you very nicely.
Fuck you very much, right?
As soon as we finish this, I'm on that floor exercising. You know? I mean, oh my God. So, and then
so for our listeners, if you would like to email us at theagency.podcast@gmail.com with your interpretations of my dreams.
Yes, I love it.
That would be fantastic. We'll read them out on the air in the next episode.
I love it.
Let me just tell you that one of the areas I went into was like an airplane hangar, and there were guys who were like technicians who just ignored me, just like I belonged there. And there were all kinds of little rooms and doors. Oh. And I'd go through the doors and there would be more stairs and places to go. And I also emerged into a giant shopping mall, which was the sort of the hellish part of the dream.
Hmm.
You know, it was like Yorkdale on steroids or something, or Mall of the Americas or something like that. Oh. And then I opened another door and there was the amusement park. And then another door, there was really heavy machinery and some kind of industrial complex and cranes. I have no idea what the heck they were doing. It was really noisy. I remember it was noisy. And that's really all I can remember. I just couldn't find my mechanics place again.
Right. I think that's a lot to remember there.
Normally, I never remember my dreams. So I just mentioned it because it's rare that I remember it. And not only that, usually if I do remember my dreams, I'll remember my dreams while I'm lying in bed for a few minutes. And by the time I get up, they're fugitive and they've drifted away and I can't remember.
Yeah, me too. I think though that this one obviously was there. It's important because you remembered it. I am of the camp that our unconsciousness is there to help us solve our problems. So that's how I treat dreams. I think that I'm trying to solve something. In fact, I've solved paintings. I've solved thoughts and everything in my dreams, especially when I'm writing a paper. I go into my dreams and I am having the craziest dreams. And when I wake up, I look at my dream and I've told myself some answers. Well, it's pretty amazing.
That makes sense because we know that much of the learning that we do happens not during, say, a classroom
Correct.
Setting. It happens at night.
Yes, absolutely.
There's a fellow... his company is called Brain Joe, and he teaches, he's actually a neurologist or a neuroscientist, and he does, I think I mentioned this in one of the early episodes.
The violin lessons?
He does different kinds of lessons.
Right, you That'd told us fiddle, about him, yeah. Oh, fiddle, I'm sorry.
But what he stresses is that there's not a lot of value in practicing for 3 hours at a time. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more value in taking the 3 hours and breaking it up into 15-minute sessions with time in between because your subconscious needs time to work on it.
Absolutely.
And the best time to practice is just before you go to bed because a lot of that learning happens at night. And furthermore, he recommends visualization before you go to bed.
Oh, wow.
So in the case of, say, learning a fiddle tune, you would try to visualize the bowing and the fingering and try to hear the tune in your head as if you're actually playing it before you go to bed. And apparently that kind of visualization really helps with the sort of brain mapping that you need to do to learn.
Very cool. You know, the unconsciousness, it could use words. It does not use language. It uses visual to tell us things. It teaches us through the visual. You'd think it would be so easy for the unconscious, if it's trying to help us, just tell us a message. But apparently the unconscious, as far as we know, doesn't really care for language.
Isn't that interesting?
Isn't it? Because it communicates visually and through atmosphere. I'm one of those people that I have a confused senses. I smell, color, I taste.
Synesthesia.
Yeah, I taste fabric. I taste patterns on fabric and stuff like that. And so I feel like that's kind of...
I'm in awe of that. You know that.
Oh, really? I don't know any difference. So I don't think it's at all helpful. I just think it's some part of... probably partly related to maybe my learning disability I had when I was a kid or something. I don't know if I had a bonk on the head or whatever. But, you know, I think that I think it sort of explains a lot of how I will combine even topics. I'll overlap various topics kind of compulsively too. But yeah, I think it's very interesting. So I would say I've tasted things in my dreams and I've noticed texture in my dreams, but no words. There's no words in there telling me like, hey, by the way, turn right tomorrow when you want to go left. Instead, you'll find the way to the mystery castle or your mechanic, right? It doesn't say that. It's all images. And I guess that's because that's the oldest thing long before language. We had our visual iconography.
I guess my dream was kind of like a quest, right? Wasn't it?
Totally.
Right? Because the quest was to get back to the mechanics, back home.
And... also, mechanic. It's I got to laugh over here about the mechanic part because it's like so much of the brain, so much a painter, so much a scientist. You know, you're dealing with the mechanics of making a story, a narrative on a canvas.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
it's an awesome dream.
So the other news here, completely different topic, is my lettuce is finally bolting.
What does bolting mean?
Well, what happens is with lettuce is when it gets really, really hot, it goes to seed. Mm-hmm. So we call that bolting. And instead of looking like lettuce, it grows about 3 feet tall.
Oh, yeah.
And all the leaves become really, really small.
Yeah.
And so that's really about the end of your lettuce.
Yeah.
So if you can keep it from bolting as long as possible. So
right.
I am prepared for this because I have some bok choy seeds.
Oh, nice.
Which are have a good tolerance to bolting.
Does it help how you pick the lettuce or anything like that? Or
I think when it gets too hot, it just bolts.
Yeah.
Okay. So some things like spinach, which bolts really, really quickly, you want to plant as early as you can work the ground. Even like snow won't even hurt spinach. If you can work the ground and get your spinach seeds in, you plant them, that spinach will come up and you'll have wonderful spinach before anyone has any vegetables. And if you instead wait until most people are planting their gardens and you plant your spinach comes up and immediately bolts.
Okay.
So some lettuces have a higher tolerance for bolting, but it's been so hot here that my lettuces are all going. So this afternoon, after we finish recording, I'm going to be planting my at least some of my bok choy. I'm going to try to sort of do it in sections. Plant some and then plant some more in 2 weeks.
Very cool. Very cool. I've got a lot of herbs that I can't eat fast enough. And the lettuce is long gone. We had three. I could only find three plants of lettuce. I should have bought way more, and we don't have any left. The chard, we kind of ate the other day. It went pretty fast too. We just have little planters, nothing big.
It's nice to grow a little bit of food and eat the food that you've grown.
True.
You know that somebody hasn't doused it with nasty chemicals.
That's right.
Gassed it in a truck so it stays fresh longer.
That's right.
You know, all those nasty things.
Eradicated it or whatever they do.
You know, we had some bagels that were Dempster's bagels. Okay.
And they're
the kind of bagels, instead of coming loose in a bin, they come packaged up with six in a package.
Oh.
Well, there was one bagel left in the package, and it kind of got buried in the jumble of stuff where we keep our bread.
Yeah.
And
this bagel,
it must have been 2 weeks old.
Oh, and, no.
And, you know, if you have a piece of pita, which has no preservatives, after about 3 days, it starts to get green spots. You got to eat that stuff right away. But this bagel that was left after 2 weeks, it looked just like it was fresh.
I thought you were going to go the other way. Okay.
No. I don't know what they do to it, but I don't want to know. It's scary, man.
Because
that bagel should be in really rough shape, but it was fine.
Yeah.
So we toasted it up and gave it to the partners.
Oh, okay. Good idea. Yeah, I guess there's something in there, sodium or something. Why am I even trying to guess what's in there? I wouldn't have a clue. It's on the package, I'm sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, very good problems with painting, dreaming, getting my car fixed. I have not got my new battery on my phone, but I'll do that tomorrow. A big lineup at the Apple store.
How's your car?
The car is wonderful. It was the line that you mentioned.
Just had to replace the hose?
Yeah, except then it damages the pump. So you're kind of lost. You know, you got to do it.
Oh, so you had to replace the pump too?
Because the pump gets damaged on the drive to the mechanic. So I had the choices of tow it or drive it. It's like win-win, you know, it's like whatever. But again, I want to say I feel very grateful. I was at the bank this morning and I saw so many people keeping social distance. I end up talking to a whole bunch of people and everyone's just not sure what to do that I talk to, trying to do their best civic duty, trying to get by, feeling like they're not really sure where anything's going to go. And I felt so much love for the human race. I just feel like let's get through.
You didn't happen to record any woman on the street interviews, did you?
No, I did not. You know, I love doing that. I did not do that, but I did record an interview this week. Thank you for the brilliant segue. My point being that here I'm got my problems, and some people are out there actually doing some real work. I interviewed a very well-known activist in Chicago, Andy Thayer, a pretty remarkable person. I've run into him and participated in some of his protests and his efforts. And he gave us a few minutes of about a half hour interview last couple of days. And I'd love to share that with everyone. So this is a bonus episode.
Excellent. I haven't heard it yet either. So I'll be listening later with our audience.
Great.
So thank you very much for doing that, Candy.
Yeah, I'm kind of thrilled. And I love to think about different things, just like the nuns living in a cloister. I like to read about different ideas and talking to someone who's really dedicated his life to this. One thing that does happen with protests, sometimes they work, but they work by being persevering. What happens is that people, if they don't like their leaders and society, those protests can kind of trigger a landslide. But most of all, what happens is sometimes when somebody does a protest, they might become a long life a lifelong protester, and that's what Andy Thayer did. So I'm looking forward to sharing that with you all.
He probably, and if people respond to his protests, he's probably a natural born leader.
He really is a natural born leader. And I actually meant to ask him about that, but we didn't really get to that. He's pretty self-effacing. So you'll find out.
One of the things that I learned when I was working in the workaday world for 30 years is that most people don't know what leadership is.
Yes.
And don't realize that leaders need followers.
Yes.
And my experience is that most companies hire leaders who are just like them because they assume that the way they are is the best way to be.
Well, that sounds tragic.
So it's very difficult to get change in a corporate environment because people keep hiring people who are very much like them. And it's something that I saw year after year after year. And it's not always good. It's usually not good. It could be good. If you have a great leadership team and they keep finding the kinds of leaders that, you know, that they are, that's a great thing. But if you're trying to change a culture, it's very, very difficult to do, you know, without, you know, doing a wholesale change at the top.
For sure.
And of course, in that environment, it's never the top that gets changed. It's usually the bottom that gets changed, right?
True. And one thing I know is nature loves diversity. So you want diversity in your corporations. You want diversity even in your protesters. You want diversity everywhere. That is a healthy go-to set point for nature. And, you know, that's what a lot of the protests in the last 100 years or 200 years have been about. So, without spending much more time, shall we go to it?
Let's do it.
Okay, and the I'll get that out there later on, and I'll talk to you soon in a couple days, Eugene.
Okay.
All right, great.
Bye.
Bye. Three, two, one. I'm very happy to say that we're with Andy Thayer, an activist in the Chicago scene for quite a long time. Andy, how you doing?
Just fine. Thank you, Candy.
Good. I'm so glad you were able to talk with us today and maybe help us understand what a protester is, what the protest life is like. You know, some of our listeners are going to be from small towns and they might not know what's going on and what it's like to be in a protest.
Well, I'm from a very small town myself.
I
grew up about 3.5 miles outside of a one-stop light town in upstate New York. So there you go.
Wow. Wow, you seem very urban, which could lead me to a good question right away is, did you know the first time you started to have thoughts about being a social activist? Did it come from your family from books?
You know, I didn't think of myself as a social activist for many years. It's something that sort of when other people start labeling you that as such, then, but the label wasn't very important to me, frankly. The most important thing was that I was very angry about particular issues. My mom was a longtime activist, but she and my dad purposely never proselytized any of their children. And so me and my siblings went in very different directions. In fact, one of my brothers is a Trumpite, you might say.
Wow.
With all that implies.
Yes, sure.
So are you able to?
but you are able to navigate some communication with him.
Yes. He, on principle, did not attend my husband's and my wedding, and that has always put a barrier. And he still doesn't figure it out.
But, that's tough. I'm sorry to hear that. That hurts when it's especially a brother and a sister or a sibling, because it's like a free friend, right?
Yeah.
But you're not alone in this situation, Andrew. We all have people in our lives that we don't agree with, right?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And we, you know, I try and stick to my principles. And what that often means is that the conversations are on a very superficial level, because he knows that I'll speak my mind if he says something that I find.
Is there any humor involved in it at all, or is it pretty like a really tender eggshells?
You know, his wife is really, frankly, in outer space. And I tried using irony on her once, and it was clear to me that irony, it went right past her. So there's no attempt at humor that's going to work in that circumstance. The best you can do is try and do some self-preservation and not allow them to get away with stuff that they shouldn't be getting away with.
Well, totally. And it's hard when you're in a relationship yourself and you want to try and be everyone together, but if someone's hurting people's feelings, that's not cool.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, I think that all of us who are in marriages or other relationships where our partner is likely the source of a target of abuse, it really is our duty to put ourselves between that. I do that to the best that I can.
Yeah, it's tough. And, you know, I think it is especially difficult for gay people, lesbian people. I have countless friends who there's problems in their family. They miss outings, or their partner just decides to not even be involved anymore. You know, like, we're going to move forward without this because it's never going to reconcile. I'm sorry to hear it. I'm sorry to hear it in anyone's family. My mother might not have been politics, but she really had a special talent at alienating people. So, you know, I know what you're talking about.
Same thing about me.
Okay. Well, a lot of people say the same thing about me. So I think you and I have that in common. We're both, seem to be able to say things and we don't care what the response is. I don't know. Maybe we do, or maybe we don't fully understand.
Well, one thing that I learned from my mom was that you have to stand up for what's right, whether it's popular or not. And that example that she showed for me, as I said, I grew up in a one-stop light and I really only began to understand this more fully in my young adulthood. Mm-hmm. She smuggled draft evaders across the border into Canada during the Vietnam War. She was involved in some fairly radical anti-pollution efforts and a number of other things that democratic town, if you will, a liberal suburb or whatever, would mark her as on the far left of the spectrum. But in a solid, almost lily white rural town, made her a bomb throwing communist, if you will.
Wow.
She spoke her mind.
Yes.
It really was her example rather than her proselytizing. And really what started me on the road to, radicalism and activism it must have been in late junior high or early high school where I picked up a book off my mom's shelves. It was a rainy afternoon. I was not a reader. Mm-hmm. And that book happened to be Bury My Heart, It Wounded Me.
Oh,
and
you and me both.
I enjoyed history, as badly taught as it was in junior high and high school. And when I realized the lies I'd been being told and about how the United States government was so profoundly evil and murderous towards Native Americans, it really turned my world upside down. Mm-hmm. And that began my long descent into not trusting most of my elders. There were obviously some, like my mom, that I trusted, but most of them I felt like I'd been lied to.
You know, it's very funny. That's about the last thing I expected you to say, but I guess it makes sense. That book completely changed my life. And it devastated my life, in fact. And I grew up in a very liberal, progressive schools. not so much focused on academia, really on the arts and community on the West Coast of Canada. And there was like, it had to be 6 months to a year. And all of our friends read the same book and we were obsessed. So it was also a generational influence. And I think that I'm seeing that with you right now. So maybe I shouldn't be so surprised that that went by you. And that book does come up in a lot of people's past. I just was not expecting that. I'm kind of blown away by it. You've sparked some memory in me in my childhood reading that book.
Well, and the funny thing is it was totally random. And I think my path to where I am now was really a lot of fortunate experiences and chances, and certainly not anything planned out. Being gay is terribly painful as it was in this very right-wing homophobic town. I see is ultimately making me a much better person. It forced me to re-examine all sorts of things as I realized that this is a society that is so profoundly bigoted that it forced me to hate myself. Oh. That it could do that kind of head trip on me. Showed to me that the society had to be transformed from top to bottom. It helped make me become a revolutionary. And you know, this was the mid to late 70s into the early 80s. And one of the things I first did when I went to school was to study about South Africa and how the African National Congress had tried every means that were allowed within the circumscribed confines of apartheid South Africa to get their rights. They started out as a very, you know, shall we say, tepid, respectable politics sort of organization, and they were forced. Every time they started to make some gains via the legal proper route, of course, those routes would be closed to them by passage of laws and so forth. And that's what made them realize that the South African government had to be overthrown. And I extrapolated that example of a regime which had its back to the wall and how it reacted, how it violated its own very circumscribed democratic norms, and yet would still reach for the bullets. Mm-hmm. That is something that I extrapolated out to not just the United States, but governments around the world, that they will try to rule by consent of the governed when they can, but they will reach for their weapons, of which they've got plenty.
Well,
if they feel their power truly threatened.
That's a very well articulated paradigm shift in your life. That's really profound. You know, there's not everyone comes out this way. Not every gay person or not every woman who's called a slut as a girl becomes a feminist. Not every gay guy that's bullied becomes an activist. You know, so there's still something special in your family, in your life, for you to feel that drive and that sacrifice.
I feel myself a victim of lucky circumstances.
Yes. No, I think that's a great coming. I think that's a great way to articulate it. I love it. Listen, I'm going to jump to something else. When I looked at your bio, and you're probably the first person we've interviewed on this podcast that has a Wikipedia page, by the way, I was kind of impressed. I was taken with the news that you have protested in Moscow. Are you able to talk to me about that?
Oh, yes, yes.
I don't understand how you could go there. And did they know you were going to protest?
Well, and I found this here in the city of Chicago. Never underestimate the utter incompetence of government bureaucracy.
And
both here in Chicago as well as in Russia, we caught some breaks thanks to that incompetence.
Oh, I see.
Because you know, if they'd done, say, a Google or whatever, they would have found whatever.
They would have found your Wikipedia page.
But my passport says Andrew.
Uh-huh.
And Andrew was simply visiting Russia to study the Great Patriotic War as an amateur historian. And that's why he was going to Russia. And Andy Fair was there for more nefarious purposes.
Oh, you're good.
And I thought, certainly, well, they'll let me in the first time.
Yeah.
They might let me in the second time, but the third time is like, boy.
But if
you'd seen Moscow customs at the time, it really was a joke, because there was one line for people to declare, and there was another line for people with nothing to declare. And as this huge jumbo jet disgorged every single person, including, of course, myself, not knowing a word of Russian except for thank you, streamed through the do not declare. And that was Moscow incoming customs.
I feel so ignorant. I had no idea that many people were going to Moscow from the USA.
Well, there were very few on our flights.
Okay.
It wasn't a direct flight, but this is the people who travel via air in Moscow are in Russia are going to be the elite.
Those typically
who are offspring of or are themselves the people connected to the kleptomaniac bureaucracy.
Right.
And so, of course, there's the clash. The class divides in Russia are extremely stark. I don't know, Candy, if you're familiar, maybe some of your listeners are familiar with the Chicago projects back in the day. The destitute high rises where they warehoused black people here in Chicago.
I'm familiar.
Just row upon row after row of these, leaden gray concrete high rises. Mm. In Moscow, the city is ringed by many, many, many times those horrible buildings that used to be a commonplace along, say, the Dan Ryan Expressway here in Chicago. And that's the way the vast majority of Muscovites live, and that's where a huge proportion of the Russian population lives. I think something like a quarter of the population lives in Moscow and its environs, in the biggest country in the world.
Wow.
So this class divide, it was really stark to me.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Did you go on the plane with other activists, or did you meet and convene there, or what kind of numbers are we looking at the events?
I was the only one on the flights that I was on, and I was met at the airport by my Russian friends, whom I had been in contact with beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And this all started because they were reaching out to Western activists to help them provide some political cover, frankly, for them to hold Moscow Pride.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a strategy not unlike what the African-American, the Black Civil Rights Movement in the South used way back in the day, when the governments of the Southern states didn't think twice about murdering Black people.
Mm-hmm.
But murdering white people, well, that's another thing.
Okay.
And so Freedom Summer was in part, let's bring some white college students down here because the state is going to be less, and the Klan are going to be less likely to murder them than us, and will hopefully provide a measure of safety. It's a very twisted concept in that people of your own region are less valuable to the elites of that area than outsiders. I found the same thing in Honduras when I visited there on one of the Solidarity delegations. We had warning shots fired at us by the thugs of the biggest landowner in the country, and we were mostly North Americans, and as I and others remarked afterwards, if we had been Hondurans, they would have been aiming at us and not above us. It's a very sick phenomenon. So I traveled to Moscow at the invitation of Russian LGBTQs, and they still arrested us, but probably they treated the whole group less severely than they would have otherwise because there was international press attention.
Okay.
Thanks only to the fact that there were, you know, people from other countries there. Right. They did treat the Russians worse than they did us, though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good strategy, though, and it must have been pretty amazing to see that and be part of it.
Yeah, it was certainly an education. Certainly an education.
How do you feel gay liberation is going in Russia right now?
It's very difficult. You know, a lot of this I put to the economic difficulties that the country is undergoing now. There was we had a good thing going there in terms of international solidarity. Yeah. I felt for a few years in terms, but then Western activists who, frankly, probably half of them couldn't have found Russia on a map a few years before. Oh. Got into this whole sort of nationalist thing about, you know, United States being, you know, so much more superior and so forth. And right. It's something I see. And it's really under the name, under the guise of international solidarity, it's really the opposite. And it just provoked a lot of nationalism on the Russian side.
Okay.
And nationalism in Russia is very, very stark, in part due to what the country suffered during the Second World War. I mean,
yes.
The estimates vary, but I think the figure, as I recall, was at least 20 million people died, far Absolutely. More than any other country during that war. And so nationalism is a very, very real feature in that country, even right. more so than I'd argue here in the United States.
Right. Yeah, I have 20 million in my head too for that figure, which I got from Oliver Stone's Secret Untold History of the USA, which I highly recommend to anybody listening. Wow, that is, it's really Honduras, and just that you've gone internationally is really, I'm kind of blown away. You know, there's a quote by Milan Kundera. It says, "The struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting." Does that have resonance for you? And how do you keep focused? And I mean, you're not just starting out a couple of years ago. You've been doing this most of your life.
Well, I guess it's a question of also what memory. I hadn't heard that quote before, and it certainly has got me thinking. One of the things that I wish many younger activists today who are, to their eternal credit, leading the Black yes. Lives Matters movement and really have pushed this country into a very different place than it was just a few months ago,
yes.
is that you need to be leading these struggles because the young have always led our movements. Mm. But you need to be more careful about learning from the past. That there are going to be any number of forces that are going to attempt to use you and your energy and your reputations for nefarious means. Oh. The non-governmental organizations in particular will attempt to use you. And the NGOs in this country are almost, not almost exclusive, I should say, in their vast majority, tied to the Democratic Party, which uses the NGOs to in turn use activists. And if they can't successfully use them, they will crush those movements. That was the history of Occupy.
Okay.
That was the history, I think, that's being attempted today versus mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter activists. It was attempted to use against the post-Ferguson Black mm-hmm. Lives Matter activists that, if you begin to think about it, these protests in terms of both those sets of movements have been largely against cities that are run by Democratic mayors. And I think to a one, Black Lives Matter activists and Occupy's activists are thoroughly repulsed by the Republican Party and Donald Trump and everything he stands for. But we need to see how we got into this awful situation in the first place. And a lot of that was paid for by years and years of neoliberal Democrats saying all sorts of nice things oftentimes, but then putting the boot in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I mean, it goes back to Clinton and before. I'm talking about Bill, with, you know, the mass incarceration. Clinton was notorious for all sorts of nasty anti-gay stuff, such as the Defense of Marriage Act, Donuts Don't Tell. And yet they were all full of promises for things like protecting unions, paycheck, card sign up for unions, opposing NAFTA and so forth. And yet they were the biggest proponents of some of this stuff. And when they actually get into office, this is the garbage that they push. They can point out to Trump being a nasty thug, which is true, but these same Democrats support record funding for the state of Israel, which is brutally repressing Palestinians and is in the process of formally taking over much of the West Bank right now. And these policies of dominating other peoples abroad, dominating people locally and domestically with police forces have been thoroughly bipartisan.
Right. Right. You know, I'm hearing something, and it ties into a question I was going to ask about part of the protests and revolutions in the last 15 years have been different in that they are decentralized, democratic, egalitarian. And that seems to respond to this feeling of like, how do we, you know, everyone's voice matters. And yet, you know, your childhood feeling that you couldn't trust adults. And I certainly felt like I didn't trust adults when I was a kid. And then now you're in a position of being a historian of this kind of the activism you've done in Chicago, at least, which also reminds me, are you going to write a book? You can answer that later. And then how do we keep that kind of feeling of like, maybe kids don't trust older people now?
Well, I think it's a healthy influence. Cause
I do too. I
wish there was more of it even.
I agree. I'm fine sitting over here and you can be mad at me. I can handle it.
Exactly.
I will support you. Yes.
I mean, so many adults have frankly betrayed them. Yes. You know, our generation, I don't know how old you are, Candy, but I look at
I'll never tell. At
people of my generation, all the prominent people, it seems, have more frequently than not betrayed the next generation, whether you're talking about climate change, whether you're talking about endless wars, whether you're talking about the increasing gulf between the vast majority of people in this country and tiny minorities in terms of income. I look at, you know, younger generations than me now, and if I was part of those generations, I would be super pissed at the boomers, et cetera.
I think they are.
Because this is the first generation, first generations of young people are going to do much less well than their predecessors, than their parents. They're not going to be, we had a whole generation of black home ownership that was wiped out in the 2008-09 recession, while the banks made out like bandits.
Right, absolutely.
And we had the first opportunity, really, in black history for one generation to be able to pass on to the next generation some home equity, some more ability to attend college, to do all the things that could get them a step up that white people have enjoyed for generations. And that was all thrown away by the bailouts of the banks and no bailouts for particularly black and Latinx people. And you see that in the devastation of much of the West and South sides. When Johnson and others in the city scratch their heads and say, "Well, we've got to do something about this violence," it has everything to do with the fact that black people have been screwed in this town for decades, and people reach a level of desperation where nihilism is understandable.
Yes.
It's a survival, you know, a reaction, which every human being would go through if faced with such desperate circumstances.
How do you stop from being cynical? And how do you, and maybe you are only cynical, but is there joy in activism? Is there joy? Can you enjoy a nice dinner with your friends? I mean, you know, part of me is I don't like to post photos of food on Facebook because I've worked with homeless and people who live outside and food is an issue. You know, there's a kind of a guilt. Do you have that? How do you reconcile it? Do you have, I would think out of anybody in this world, you might sleep really well at night because you're doing so much.
You know, I frequently, don't sleep well, to be frank, okay. Candy, because I've got a fairly stressful job. Okay. And when you're organizing things and you no doubt feel this, mm-hmm. when you're on the eve of event that you're organizing and the thing that goes through my mind is I can't let other people down.
No, that's true.
I promise
very true.
To do something.
Yes.
And I feel that responsibility. After the event is over, that's another thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think there are tremendous challenges that human beings face right now. And all of us, to the extent that we can, need to step up, or we're not going to have a planet a generation from now or even sooner. Mm-hmm. And so that from time to time does weigh heavily on me, as I'm sure it does many, many other people.
Yes.
At the same time, I do really try and take joy in the small things, whether it's just enjoying a quiet meal with my husband or, you know, just being outside in this wonderful weather. Mm-hmm. I do enjoy things like that. And I am cynical, yes, frequently, but I'm cynical, I think, about the right things. I'm cynical about power. I'm cynical about people who are well-placed, who say they want to help us. And I think that's a very healthy cynicism. But I'm really trying to, and I think all of us, especially as we get older and we're activists, we really need to be very forgiving for younger people who are joining the movements today, because none of us are perfect. Mm-hmm. None of us joined activism with either pure motives or pure hearts or pure knowledge or any of that stuff. And so I think there's often a hyper criticism towards people who mean well, but maybe making mistakes. Mm-hmm. And human beings, unless we are patient with each other, can just get our backs up. And I think a gentle, I disagree and here's why, goes much farther in terms of changing the behavior, which is actually the goal, I would hope.
Yes.
Than just leading with your emotions. And I think this is, oftentimes your emotions are right on and they're way to lead, mm-hmm. but sometimes they're not, and just leading with your emotions, leading with your gut can put you in a very bad place. The point is to win. The point is not to feel good. The point is to win. Now, oftentimes those goals will coincide, but sometimes they won't. My earlier example of my mom saying things, and I can see in my own personal political history, sometimes saying things that were painful to say, that sure as hell were not easy at the time, were not easy for much time after that, that sometimes not doing the thing that feels good is the right thing to do. When we came out in September of 2001 against the clearly impending U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, mm-hmm. we probably, in terms of at least the United States, had low single digits on our side in terms of poll numbers.
Right.
And we got a lot of very angry reactions, racist reactions from within the LGBT community, let alone outside of it, when we came out with that position. You fast forward to today, the overwhelming majority of people in the United States want the United States out of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. They see this as a failed war, and of course the politicians continue with it because they could give a damn about the fate of Afghans, U.S. soldiers, let alone being liked by any of us.
Right.
But that was, and when I was a gay activist at Northwestern University, where I went to school mm-hmm. in the late 70s into the early 80s, there were only, most of that time, only two of us who were quite publicly out on campus.
Wow.
But I'd like to think that we helped make it easier for others.
I think so.
Afterwards.
I think so. Do you have a wish list of pressing issues you want to see come to the surface right now? In the next few months, or?
I think U.S. wars.
Okay.
It's great that the Black Lives Matters activists, and especially the ones from the Ferguson generation, mm-hmm. they recognize that U.S. wars are as bad, if not worse, in terms of devastating Black and brown people as the police.
Yes.
And
do you mean that by being drafted, by being put into service?
I'm sorry, say again, please.
I just want to qualify that. That's because so many Black and Latinx people served. Is that what you mean?
Well, I think the Ferguson generation of Black Lives Matter activists who are leading groups like Black Lives Matter Chicago, mm-hmm. Torture Justice Center, and others, Asada's Daughters, they understand the international connections. Mm-hmm. They not only oppose this insane U.S. military spending, they're in total solidarity with Palestine. They realize all the links between U.S. oppression, repression abroad, and U.S. oppression, repression here at home. They got it.
Right.
I think the newer generation of people have got to realize it's not enough to be against funding the police and the domestic repressive apparatus, that the international repressive apparatus, the U.S. armed forces, in terms of the uses to which they're put, are at least as evil. Now, the contrast between the U.S. armed forces and the police is that the police, you can't survive as an Black Lives Matter person
right. In
the police force, because you're forced to do all sorts of things on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the armed forces, the history of the Vietnam War certainly teaches us this, as well as later groups such as Iraq Veterans Against the War. The people can go into the armed forces with very noble intent or just needing to get a job. And then like people like Chelsea Manning, realize just how evil the institution is and turn against it and start organizing against it from inside. Right. I mean, that was a key factor in the U.S. defeat in Vietnam. I just think that people give a pass to things like U.S. patriotism too often. This notion that the United States is in some respects inherently better than other peoples around the world and has some sort of U.S. exceptionalism right to rule other peoples in the world or tutelage them. And one thing is that I've seen, and I'm not as well traveled as you imply, Candy, but one thing I have seen about LGBT movements in other countries is they're frequently light years ahead of that of the United States. The example I'd like to give is particularly Honduras, which I have the most recent experience with, albeit not, certainly not encyclopedic, but the Honduran movement started out, according to people that I talked to in it, very similar in some respects to that in the United States. They were only concerned with themselves. They were only concerned with their own rights. It was gay rights only. Gay men only concerned themselves with gay men, et cetera, and that was the end of it. And then the 2009 U.S.-sponsored coup in Honduras totally overturned people's lives. And LGBT activists saw that they needed to be in solidarity with campesinos, they needed to be in solidarity with unions, they needed to be in solidarity with everyone who had a beef against the new dictatorial regime. And it was an eye-opening for them. And in many respects, that consciousness was similar to the consciousness we saw in the early years of the gay liberation movement in this country following 1969 Stonewall Rebellion. Mm-hmm. That the activists in that early Stonewall movement were anti-war. They organized in the anti-war movement as open LGBTs. Mm-hmm. They organized in solidarity with the Black Panther Party against racism and police violence, such to the point that the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense became the first large, quote-unquote, non-gay organization to publicly embrace what they called at the time gay liberation. Wow. Huey Newton made a very, very famous statement about this. This was not just a passing press release or anything uh-huh. like this. This was a seminal movement in the New Left, because mm-hmm. the New Left up to then had been dominated by a Stalinist politics that was homophobic, deeply homophobic, was very, very frequently crassly sexist and misogynist. And that was the first big break in that set of politics that helped propel the New Left forward from a cul-de-sac, to be frank.
Right, right.
And ultimately, I mean, radical women from the gay liberation movement of the time played a key role in radicalizing the women's liberation movement at the time, which was very deeply into what today we'd call respectability politics. And that new birth of radical politics played an important role in winning us Roe v. Wade in 1973. Mm-hmm. And if you know, the history that I would hope that young activists look to today, and look carefully, don't just look at the cliches, don't do some serious reading about this. Look at the history of how and why our early gay liberation movement, the early women's movement of the late 60s, early 70s, the Black Power movement, why is it those movements were able to make the impact that they did, to the point where for decades after that, all these right-wing foundations have been trying to wind those movements back.
Right.
The so-called Vietnam Syndrome, which was a result of the defeat of the United States in Vietnam, not only saved many, many people more in that country from a war that would grind on the way that the Afghan occupation continues today, but it also saved people in other countries subsequently. Gerald Ford tried to intervene in the Angolan Civil War and was stopped because of the Vietnam Syndrome. Any number of presidents subsequent, it was only by the time we reached Ronald Reagan where they attempted to reestablish a so-called kick the Vietnam Syndrome, that they began doing these pinprick invasions of mighty communist threats like the island of Grenada. That's irony there.
Yes.
That movement, because that anti-Vietnam War movement undoubtedly saved millions of people's Black mm-hmm. and brown lives around mm-hmm. the world. Mm-hmm. And the key to it was not only mass involvement, but the absolute key that everyone I think overlooks is that it was independent of both political parties. Mm. That is the key to the power of all the great social movements we've seen in this country in the modern era. It was the key to the power of the union movement of the 1930s. It was the key to the power of the post-World War II, late 50s into the early 60s, Black civil rights movement. And all of that independence came due to particular historical reasons, which I've written about several times now.
Yeah.
But, you know, especially with the siren song of the Democrats this November of "We're Not Trump," I think it's important that people look to that history and look to how they are going to get the things, the sweeping changes, whether on climate change, whether it's defunding police, and so on and so forth, that people demand today. How are you going to really get those?
Yeah.
I think earlier movements, that independence from both political parties was key.
Right. And now, do you have a way that you might recommend that if people wanted to support protests or get involved or find out a little bit more, is there a book you would recommend or a website or your Facebook page you would recommend?
Well, I there's the Chicago Activism Action Network, which is a Facebook group.
Great.
Where things are frequently posted. There's the Chicago protest. I'm probably getting these wrong, and people can follow me on Facebook. It's,
right.
It's Andy Thayer.
That's what I thought.
I do try and post about this stuff. I mean, there are so many protests these days right now.
Yes.
Fortunately, none of us can keep up with all of it.
Right.
And that's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
I am frankly, and I've said this to several people over the past few weeks, I'm more optimistic about our prospects for real change as opposed to the kind of change that Democrats and Republicans promise us. I'm more optimistic about real change happening now than I have been, frankly, since I've ever been an activist.
I'm so glad to hear that. And I think that something really is happening, and it's from the people, it's grassroots, it's real. I think it's the greatest thing we've ever seen.
Yes. In our lifetime, certainly.
In our lifetime, yes. Well, I hope you write a book.
I can find time. I still want to retire.
Okay.
My paying job.
All right. Well, listen, it's been actually really amazing talking to you. I was a little intimidated, to tell you the truth. I was quite nervous, and you were totally charming and wonderful.
Oh, thank you, Candy. You're so sweet. Thank you so much.
Oh, my God. No, thank you so much. And I'm going to work on that. That'll probably be next week, okay?
Okay.
Thank you for your time. Anything last minute you want to say?
Trust. Get out into the streets. Trust your peers and not our so-called leaders. That movements are made up of regular folks just like ourselves. The whole so-called great man theory of history, that we're going to be led to the promised land by this or that great figure, that's bogus. That's not real history. The history is of people, frequently anonymous, doing the right thing in concert with their neighbors, their coworkers, their fellow students. That's how we'll free ourselves.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Candy.
We'll see you out in the streets.